When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. I had to go about it, write it out, and find it myself.
And there's some stories I can tell you. It's the Final Word Cricket Podcast with Adam Collins and Jeff Lemon, back for another week, our 12th season, our 8th episode. It's been another busy week around the cricketing world. We have an interview coming up later with the authors of the new book, Crickonomics, The Anatomy of Modern Cricket, with Stefan Siminski and Tim Wigmore, who Final Word listeners will know well. It's the book that I always expected Tim would end up writing, and he's combined with Stefan, who was the author of Soconomics that was everywhere a few years ago. So it's a perfect marriage of sorts as authors, and they've produced a wonderful book, and I'm looking forward to talking about it later.
Well, that's what people want. They want Tim Wigmore, not Tim Wigless. I wonder how much time goes into coming up with the title of that one, because, you know, obviously it was a stylistic choice to go for Soconomics rather than Footballnomics, because it, you know, it just sounds a bit more like economics, right? But then they're like, how do we do it with cricket? We can't do it if we use the whole word. We've got to chop off the last vowel, the last consonant rather, and make it roll through to make it Crickonomics.
It's funny you ask that. I was thinking the same thing earlier today, how they were going to implement the K or otherwise. They have gone with crick with a K before going into the onomics. I pondered how many meetings must they have with the publisher and with each other to decide they would keep the K rather than leaving it out. I reckon that might have been one of the decisions that took the longest to make. We'll see. I might ask them about it later on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it would have been, because so many others have forsaken the K. You know, no K for Crick Info, no K for Crick Buzz.
Exactly.
No K for Crick Doze, the NFT of the ICC. The K is entirely superfluous. I mean, really, we should just get a bit more phonetic, as they do. Like, one of the nice things about learning Spanish is that all of the letters just have one way of being pronounced, and that's it. Once you know what it is, it will always, like, it's always written phonetically. You always know how to pronounce a word, even if you've never seen it before. Living in Malaysia, same thing. You know, how do you spell, like, they're like, get rid of X. We don't need X. Get rid of, right, S is a soft sound. K is a hard sound. You don't need C to be like this weird halfway in between thing, but you use C to do a CH thing instead. So that's all clear. How do you spell taxi? T-E-K-S-I. Perfect. Everybody knows what's going on.
Yeah.
Right? Just, yeah, too many letters, too many pronunciations in English.
Say what you see. Also today we'll be talking about the Commonwealth Games that are coming up in a few months, where cricket's in there for the second time, women's cricket for the first time. There's the Aussie schedule that's not out, but there's a bit around that. Some assistant coaches have been appointed that are kind of interesting. There's some serious injuries in the England fast
kind of interesting is the best thing you can say about assistant coach.
Yeah, you know, I thought it was worth putting it on the rundown, but I'm not going to overplay it. I'm not going to say it's the most interesting thing we're going to talk about today, but it's noteworthy on the way through. There are a number of stress fractures for a number of bowlers, and we'll talk about them in a little bit of depth. There's another round of county cricket to get through, the last before the blast break, and there is a test series taking place in Bangladesh between the Tigers and Sri Lanka. Their nerd pledge, then interview. That's our show. We talked before about the superfluous K in Crickonomics. Well, surplus to requirements also are a number of members of parliament who are no longer there after Saturday. We kind of started talking about
smooth segue.
I know, right? It's in the intro. We've got to get to it. We sort of nearly went down this path on story time last week, which was a lot of fun, by the way. If you haven't tapped in, and you can hear Jeff and me sing the Nanny theme song in its entirety. We sort of worked it out line by line. That was the high watermark. Spoiler alert. But yeah, we started kind of like wading into politics, then we pulled out, then we edited what we said. We thought, no, we shouldn't get too political when it'll be probably election day when it's going out. But yeah, I did have that odd experience, Jeff, of not being involved in the campaign this time as I normally would be if I were in Australia. And then on top of that, instead of being with other political types, political mates, I was at Lord's commentating on Middlesex's game. So I had sort of the ABC Open, which is the only broadcast that isn't geo-blocked in the UK on election night. So that was going on one screen, and the game we were commentating on the other out there at Lords, and it was a tricky morning balancing my interests. Mm. But I think I did a halfway okay job with it. It was probably good that it wasn't a close result, that we knew who was going to form the new government within about 90 minutes of polls closing or thereabouts. But yeah, big weekend.
Well, it's something that we have to talk about at this stage because, you know, when, from my perspective, when you host a show with someone who's a former prime ministerial staffer, then you probably need to talk about the election that just happened. which is, yeah, it is interesting because I don't have your sort of team loyalty part in that I don't really follow any political party, but I just use the nexus of, are you a dick? Like, are you trying to make people's lives better, or are you trying to make life better for a small number of people who you deem are worthy because, you know, misfortune is apparently a moral failure? Like, are you doing good things to help people? Cool. Whatever colour you're wearing, whatever you call yourself, that's fine. Are you a fuckhead? Out you go. And, you know, and so I think it feels good that a bunch of fuckheads got sent out the door.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you look like a bunch of fuckheads. Off you shoot. Off you shoot. Haven't done anything. Haven't helped anyone. Not actually dealing with the problems that need dealing with. Whoever's going to deal with them, hopefully some people will in whatever kind of conglomerate they can put together. But that's the bit that made me happy.
Yeah, I was lucky as a younger fella when I was 23 to work on the Kevin 07 campaign in campaign headquarters. So it was a very exciting place to be, 11 and a half years out of office. I mean, it was an exhilarating 6 weeks and kind of defined what I'd go on to do for the rest of the decade, really. But I remember on election night when it was confirmed there'd be a change of government and the Prime Minister or the outgoing Prime Minister, John Howard, spoke, there was a sense of like respect. Like, even though you may not respect everything that he did in office, far from it, but there was a sense that a guy who's done the job for that long and done it in such a diligent way, even if you didn't like him, deserved our respect at that particular juncture. You know, you didn't sort of want to yell at the screen or anything like that. I absolutely didn't sense that on Saturday night. Like, you know, the outgoing Prime Minister this time doesn't command our respect. He's a bad dude. He's a fundamentally bad dude, and he's surrounded himself with a number of other very bad people, and they have been punted spectacularly. This is a realignment in Australian politics like we haven't seen since the split, the DLP split in the mid-50s in 1952, I think, as far as the way the Liberal Party have divided down similar lines to what you're referring to, I reckon, Jeff. And that's not to say if you're a Liberal voter, you're a scumbag. I'm not saying that. I never would. But a lot of Liberal voters have made their minds up that the government didn't deserve their support, and I think that's where it's fascinating. And yeah, it's just a wonderful thing to know that the group of people going in there now, many of whom are my friends, and I would say this because I wish them all the best and I hope it goes well, it's going to be hard. It's going to be a very, very difficult time to be in government in Australia at the back of the pandemic with all of the different economic challenges. Some are domestic, some are international, but the confluence of factors is going to make that job extremely difficult to run the show over the next 3 years. But they're doing so with some of the worst people in Australia no longer there, and that's only going to make that process more straightforward than it would be, even if Peter Dutton ends up leader of the opposition, which I expect he will.
Well, I sense it'll be a war footing from the Murdoch lot immediately. You know, suddenly we'll be hearing about national debt and things that we haven't heard about for many years. It'll become very important again all of a sudden. Deficit, disaster. So, you know, they will be going in boots and all over the next 3 years and trying to be as unhelpful as possible. But
I think that's a good thing. Just to jump in on the Murdoch media, I think that's actually a good thing. We've seen in various state elections, the harder the Murdoch press go, and that's not everybody who works for Murdoch, by the way. It's the decision makers at Holt Street and other places where they are directed to do as they do. Where the harder they have gone, the better it's worked out for us. I say go your hardest because they look less and less credible. They look more and more like the propaganda arm of the LNP, and most sound-minded Australians realise that. They know that what they're reading on the front page of the Telegraph and the front page of the Herald Sun is a construct that has little to do with reality and more to do with the interest of an old bloke that lives in New York. So I don't mind that. I say go for gold, have a crack, because I reckon Australia have moved on from that bullshit.
And when you say an old bloke, you mean a sort of eternal undead spirit that somehow remains tethered to this physical plane in some sort of semblance of a shell. It's been a peculiar time. But look, be wary of thinking the spell is broken. I heard people say that in 2007. I heard them say it in 2010. And you know,
I think the difference was in 2007. Labor won with, I think from memory, all bar two News Corp papers endorsing the opposition. This time, not a single News Corp paper from coast to coast was willing to put their endorsement in the column of the Labor Party. That's ridiculous. That shows how out of step they are with where the voters were. I mean, look at the way the swings worked in the capital cities, for example. These are nominally the newspapers for these capital cities. So, yeah, I reckon you might be right about the spell not being broken, but look at Victoria. I mean, you know, the way in which the Murdoch press went for the government and the opposition, 14-18, increased majority in 18, and I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case again in November this year. So, have a crack, guys. See how you end up.
Well, look, a couple of things I have been finding particularly amusing. One is the idea that in all of the Liberal heartland seats, you know, they found out that people can like franking credits and the environment at the same time, and that they will vote accordingly, and that the response to that has been like, well, obviously we were not right wing enough. Like, crazies didn't get any votes. Like, the One Nation, Clive Palmer kind of nut jobs got a pretty insignificant proportion.
They got 500,000 votes each across the country.
Yep. And even in, you know, a lot of the seats on first preference would have been Lib slightly ahead of Labor, but then there were massive Green votes that ensured comfortable Labor wins, and they were behind the big swings. If you look at that and be like, should have been more right wing, you know, I think we should have beaten up more trans kids. I think that really would have, you know, we didn't go hard enough. Like, that is objectively hilarious that that's the analysis coming out of the election. And the other bit was watching the ABC coverage and, Lee Sales and Annabelle Crabb going, oh, Tanya Plibersek, wow, you must be really disappointed with this result that, like, Labor's lost 1% of the vote nationally or whatever it is. There's been a swing against you. And Plibersek's like, we're going to form government, so not very disappointed. Because, believe it or not, people aren't that stupid. If they vote for independents or they vote for Greens, like in the vast majority of cases, that's not going to get you a lower house MP, but you know who you're electing with your preferences. Like, that's how the system works. People aren't that stupid to be like, I put one in this box and then after that, I don't have any opinion about two and on. They know how the system works. Like, people voted for a change of government.
Yeah, it's that great sort of cliche at the end of every campaign. It's the lowest Labor primary vote on record. You hear it every election because voting patterns have changed. When John Howard became Prime Minister, he said that 1 in 10 voters weren't aligned to a party. That's probably like 4 in 10 now. And that's okay. Mm. Like, the fact that there are more voters who are making their minds up later. Like, we have a compulsory voting system. Their votes are getting counted. Preferential voting helps with that, as you point out. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, as Barry Cassidy noted on social media, all of this hyperventilation around Labor's primary vote this time, in what are we up to now? A dozen independents being elected, of which 10 are teals. Mm-hmm. Labor voters were voting strategically. Of course, if I lived in, even as a party member, I might lose my membership over this because you're meant to vote Labor all the time, but if I was living in Kooyong, I would have voted for the teal candidate first to make sure that they were likely to come second on their primary vote. You don't want to you don't want to mess with that. You don't want to mess with the electoral gods. The best chance of getting rid of the incumbent was to vote strategically. So, of course, that means that Labor shed votes in 10 seats, and you add all of those up, it's impossible to know for sure. I've seen a couple of attempts to do so. But, yeah, it's not going to be the same primary vote that Labor was elected with in 2007. But nor was it when Abbott won in 2013, the same primary vote the Liberal Party had in 1996. Both major parties are changing their composition of votes and seats when they eventually form government. So, yeah, I thought that was just ridiculous analysis.
Yeah, with the added detail that in 2014, when Abbott got elected, they voted in a creepy carnivorous lizard to that top job who could actually shift shape. There are pros and cons for each political decision.
Right, Jeff, let's move on to the cricket, shall we? I feel like we've satisfied our urge to talk a little bit of politics off the top. Some people might have got angry about that, but it is our prerogative, for it is our podcast. There is going to be cricket in the Commonwealth Games for just the second time in August, Jeff. You and I will be at that at Edgbaston, and Australia have named their squad. Shelley Nitschke, I nearly said Dr. Shelley Nitschke, is going to be the Australian coach in an acting capacity in Matthew Mott's absence, having moved to the England men's team last week. And the squad looks...
Can we just double back on that? So presumably that means that the Doc, as we know her, will be appointed as the full-time coach in about 14 months' time after some sort of elaborate farce, after interviewing 93 candidates, after running a reality TV show where Michael Voss puts them through their paces, potential coaches for the Australian women's cricket team, after everybody gets voted off and dumped on an island, then they'll be like, oh, we've got an announcement. Shelley Nitschke will be the new coach for the Australian women's cricket team. Am I guessing that right?
I think the only other candidate might be Lottie, because she's just been appointed, Charlotte Edwards has been appointed the coach of the Sydney Sixers. Given she's in Australia for that, I suppose that might provide some pause for thought, but Shelley Nitschke's been the assistant coach for years. So if they want continuity, they will get it, I expect.
Or Ben Sawyer, who's the other assistant coach and has done good work with the Sixers, and most notably for us, was responsible for Jody Hicks getting a contract for several years rather than the big Hicks backer. So if Ben Sawyer gets to the top job, do we dare to dream? Hicks for Australia.
Yeah. And the squad they've named for the Comm Games is exactly as you'd expect. Lanning, Haynes, Brown, Carey, Gardner, Harris, Grace Harris. I didn't know she was in that. I'm glad to see she's there. Healy, Jonathan, King, McGrath, Mooney, Perry, Shute, Sutherland and Amanda Jade Wellington from South Australia. So a squad of 15. Grace Harris in the fair break the other week took a hat trick and made a couple of useful contributions with the bat. She was quite funny talking about the World Cup, and even when she was out in New Zealand, she made some quip that she got a gig because she's a good tourist. So they just wanted her around the squad because she was just a good person to have there. Well, she's a lot more than that. She's a fabulous cricketer, Grace Harris. So I hope she gets a chance to play in the Comm Games. She returned to the Aussie team during the Women's Ashes for the two T20s at Adelaide that were washed out, and then didn't play in the one dayers. So she's, you know, she's played in two international games technically.
Yep.
But the last time she batted for Australia, Jeff, would be, I reckon, 2016 or something like that. So hopefully they can get her in the squad at some point, or get her in the 11, I should say, at some point at Birmingham.
I think they've also missed a trick here, which is that I don't see Steve Waugh's name anywhere around this squad. Commonwealth Games silver medalist Steve Waugh. Now, I know that the Australian team, they will be going to Birmingham with dreams of silver. They will be hoping to replicate what the Australian men's team did in the 90s. They'll be hoping to bring home a silver of their own. You know, they'll be seeing Edgbaston awash in tones of silver. And who better to guide you on that journey than someone who's been there, someone who's done it, someone who knows about the pressures of playing in a gold medal game and not winning it, than Stephen Roger Waugh? I mean, surely, it's not too late. I'm saying Cricket Australia, it's the end of May. They don't play till, the end of July. Give him a call. He's probably snapping some photos somewhere at an orphanage or an elephant park or what have you. Get him involved. They had him in England for the Ashes in 19. Get him in for the Comm Games.
Yeah, I hear you. Brad Young can come back as well as the spinner who was the frontliner in that World Cup campaign. The Matt Mott appointment's been very well received around the place, except for one place. I saw some commentary saying that that because Meg Lanning's a strong captain, it neutralised the influence that Matthew Mott had on the dressing room, which was a bit curious. Mm. Yeah, I think it's reasonable to say that anyone that's been paying close attention realises that they formed an incredibly dynamic partnership. Mott was instrumental in resurrecting Australia's fortunes after the 2017 World Cup in England, Jeff. The best dressing rooms often have a couple of strong people there. It's not about one person defining what goes down. It's about having a number of options there, and Matthew Mott played his role perfectly, often as a spokesperson for the team, you know, as you have to do as an international coach. And the fact that he's now walking into a dressing room with strong leadership, i.e. Owen Morgan, I think that's a quite nice like-for-like, in that, yes, Lanning has ran that operation as captain for 8 years now, something like that. Mm-hmm. That's probably the same length of time that Owen Morgan's been in charge of the men's England one-day team as they lead up to their World Cup defence. So, I think that's quite a nice like-for-like.
It is, in terms of how Lanning and Morgan match up personality-wise as well. I mean, I wouldn't think of either of Mott or Lanning as forceful personalities. I mean, Lanning's quite a someone with quite a bit of self-doubt as a captain, doesn't have much self-doubt as a player, but, you know, often gets nervous and twitchy at different moments, you know, even towards the end of that Canberra test. You know, time in the job hasn't made her immune to the nerves and the pressure. But the way that those two operated was by being very calm all the time.
It was keeping
a lid on things. It was making sure that pressure didn't build up. I think that was what Mott identified in 2017 was, we're so good that we'll win 9 games out of 10, but in the 10th game when we're put under pressure, we lose our shit because we don't know how to cope with it at that point. And so that was his big thing, was to focus on players being able to respond under pressure. And I think that's what you've seen over the last 5 years or so from that Australian team. There have been so many games where things haven't been going that well, but somebody comes in ice cold in the way that Beth Mooney does or Talia McGrath does. And, you know, someone who's not one of the big couple of names from a few years ago comes in and plays the crucial hand at the crucial time. And, you know, and Mott's always been about just keeping things level, keeping things calm, accepting that we're better than most other teams, but we've also got to be better in the moments when we're challenged.
Yeah, I think that's a great summation of the Mott era, if you like. And yeah, he leaves that dressing room far better than when he arrived, and in turn they'll continue to be able to do as they do. I don't think him leaving as Australian coach provides any meaningful threat, and nor do I think his absence, if they do go on to win the Commonwealth Games gold medal or they do go on to win the next World Cup, which they probably will, suggests that he wasn't that important either. The dressing rooms have lots of different personalities, and when they're functioning at their best, as clearly this dressing room is, you have a captain and a coach that a lot of people respect and will work hard for. And I mean, Jeff, we've interviewed pretty much every Australian women's player at some point or another, and they clearly have enormous amounts of respect for both Lanning and Mott. That's why they were so effective.
And I think that what he can bring to England is, like, I reckon they need a bit of a refresh, because if you look at that England team, particularly with the batting, a lot of the same players are there as the ones who were there in 2019. It's a few years later. Most of them are into their 30s now. They're not ancient players, but they're players who've been at this for a very long time. And so then it's like, how do you put the juice into them? How do you make sure that they've stayed fresh? And he also is going to have to manage some transition stuff in the way that he did in 2017 with the Australian women's team. You look at the way they moved on from players like Elise Villani, Nicole Bolton, Alex Blackwell, and so on, the way that he was pretty ruthless, you know, even in the last few months, even with really established players, leaving out Megan Shute for certain games, Elise Perry for certain games, that kind of thing, making those calls that other coaches for other countries wouldn't do. If they had a player with that record, they would just play every single game, kind of in the way that England pick teams, you know, where there's a natural conservatism about showing some boldness and backing the next generation. So that's what he's going to have to do with the England men's team. They've got no fast bowlers. Archer keeps getting injured. Wood keeps getting injured. And they've got this, you know, not ancient but ageing batting list who are still good enough to do some damage in a year's time at the 50-over World Cup. But you've got to have them in the right headspace and the right sort of physical condition and all the rest to do it, which isn't necessarily going to happen with the amount of cricket that England play.
Yeah, and he'll command a lot of respect as well, I think, Mott, given his experience both in Australia and England, men's cricket, women's cricket. He's kind of done it all. So, yeah, I think the timing with the England dressing room's good. I think your point about a different voice just before a couple of World Cups. And you know, there's the T20 World Cup. Of course, that's important, but the real quiz for the England white ball team is retaining the 50-over World Cup next year. If they can do that, it would be an extraordinary achievement. So, yeah, looking forward to seeing how that plays out over the next 18 months or so. Now, sticking with Australia, the schedule feels like it's coming out soon. We've seen a couple of, you know, briefed yarns in the last fortnight or so. It is probably more intense than we thought, which is saying something. New Zealand and Zimbabwe are going to come out and play white ball cricket against Australia in Australia kind of at the end of winter in the lead up, or maybe spring, start of spring, end of winter, in the lead up to the 20-over World Cup, which starts in October. So effectively in that window that Australia would have played India in test cricket over in India until that was moved until March next year. Speaking of next year, they go from a home summer, then they play, or inside the home summer, sorry, they have the World Cup, then England play one days, which will be a bit odd, I reckon, but it's for World Cup Super League points, and there you go. They'll have test cricket, 5 tests, not 6, which is a bit disappointing that they're not going to have the Windies out for a third, but I suppose it's that crunch, isn't it? Much as it was when Australia hosted the Men's World Cup in 2015 and they were only able to host four test matches that previous summer. Mm-hmm. There's that extra strain on the schedule. They're going to go to South Africa after the Ashes next year to make up for the test tour that didn't happen last year. And in a way, that kind of works. They're going to play 5 one-day internationals before the 50-over World Cup in October 23. So that's how they're going to mm-hmm. make it up to Cricket South Africa for that unfortunate withdrawal last year.
So no tests. So those test matches vanish.
No, those test matches vanish until the next cycle. And the fact that they're playing test cricket in Australia means they satisfy their WTC commitment for this cycle. Mm-hmm. And I suppose, yeah, we'll have to wait a couple more years until Australia are back there for test cricket, right?
And that also kind of means, you know, maybe Steve Smith, David Warner never play another yeah. test series in South Africa.
Good point.
You know, which would have been a big thing, would have been a significant thing for them to go back and have some other chapter, you know, something else to the legacy than the last time they left.
The other interesting thing that's being floated at the moment, I think Dan Bredig had this story in The Age last week, is that the one-day internationals in the main bit of the summer, so after the test cricket's finished, mm-hmm. normally they'd be day-nighters and they wouldn't be played on the same nights as Big Bash games. Well, they're going to reconfigure it. So the one day is the day games and the Big Bash games are at night, which do relegate the one days. I mean, the glory days, Jeff, of one day internationals, midsummer, the day nighters were the peak of the summer alongside the Melbourne test match perhaps. And they're going to be taking a back seat once again. And the idea floated here is that CA are making representations to other cricket boards to ask them not to schedule international cricket during the Big Bash in that few weeks in January when they want the Big Bash to dominate. They don't want to see test cricket played presumably in South Africa, New Zealand, maybe Sri Lanka sometimes host tests in January. I found that kind of comical. I mean, as if South Africa, who have their own scheduling problems as it is, are going to acquiesce to CA because they want to have more time for the Big Bash. That's just surely not going to happen.
I mean, it's a bizarre proposition. So for what, I mean, are they hoping to sign all the South African players to come and play in
the short answer is yes. They have a image problem with the international players they're signing right now. I know the comps right. goes forever and that's their main issue structurally, but isn't there yep. a sense now, Jeff, and I don't watch it so I can't speak too deeply about it, but they're not getting the same caliber of international player they once got when the comp was shorter. Would that be reasonable?
Well, I mean, I don't even know that they got that many players of a great calibre even when it was shorter. There have been more marquee names playing in the Bangladesh Premier League than in the Big Bash, and I think CA know that. And, yeah, partly it's duration and sort of intensity of cash, and partly it's timing, and there have always been other tours because there are, you know, other Southern Hemisphere countries that need teams to tour and so on. But, yeah, the thing of prioritising it ahead of, you know, like putting the one day as this day games, it's like, why would you want to watch the national team when you can watch Peter Hatzoglu bowling to Evan Lewis, you know, our star import? And you're like, yeah, they're all good cricketers, but it doesn't have the zhuzh that it had when they were like, let's sign AB de Villiers, you know, let's get Dale Steyn. But of course, South Africa also want to start their own league, their own T20 league. And Neil Manthorpe was writing about this during the week, which potentially is going to mean that a bunch of players either can't play in the third test against Australia because they'll be needed in South Africa, or also that they'll, at the other end of January, they'll miss out on the one dayers against England, which South Africa need to win so they can try to qualify for the next World Cup. But they're also desperately short of money, and they've got this private equity T20 league with private investors owning the teams. And as Neil's pointing out, why would a private team owner be willing to accept the best players being somewhere else rather than saying, I've just put a bunch of money into your sport, I want every South African national player to be available?
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And again, it just reinforces the squeeze that's always there. The calendar is getting worse and worse and worse. And we'll talk a bit about this, I suspect, later with Tim and Stefan about scheduling, because they've looked at this in the New Zealand context, and where they've not been greedy, New Zealand, they've been willing to accept the realities of the situation and they've been better for it, where other countries just desperately want a piece of this pie, and not unreasonably, that they want to have a domestic mm-hmm. T20 comp that can succeed. But this must be South Africa's third crack at it, and if that does jeopardise what they're doing as a national team, I doubt it'll work. So, yes, let's get Manners back on the show. He's going to be in England, actually, in about a month's time working with me. So why don't we collar him then and do it in person?
Sure. Sounds good.
Australia have named a couple of assistant coaches for the men's team as well, which came out just before we started recording. Daniel Vettori, which was expected, and Andre Borovic, who was with the team in Pakistan and is going to be with the Australians in Sri Lanka too. He comes from a Premier Cricket background in Victoria, Institute of Sport, Renegades, education background too. So I think they like that holistic approach that he has. I don't know much about him, to be honest, but it takes some doing to get appointed as one of two assistant coaches. It's a pretty plum gig, so they must like him.
Well, let me tell you, I've been on the Borovic train for a while. Big Boz energy, because when I went down to give that talk to the event at Hampton Cricket Club, it was Borovic adjacent. So they had Andre Borovic lined up as their guest speaker. He was then called up to be an emergency coach for the Australian team because Justin Langer had just resigned, and so they needed a speaker, and that's when I came in. So that's when I started getting the vibes, the Borovic vibes. I was like, tell me more.
Okay.
I want to know more about Andre Borovic. And yeah, he's very, very well regarded at that kind of prem cricket level and had been doing some stuff with the Renegades, I think, as well.
Cool.
Wicket-keeping specialty too, if I remember rightly. That could be wrong, but I'm just going off the top of my head here. But yeah, he's a properly accredited and educated kind of coach rather than, you know, someone who used to play for Australia whose phone number you have in the mould of Greg Blewett, batting coach. So I think it's a better choice. And then Vettori means they're really doubling down with Andrew McDonald and Daniel Vettori on having like tall, gangly dudes with really deep voices and beards. Yeah. So they'd be like, hey guys. Oh, yeah, just thought I'd have a few observations about the game today. I probably should have tried to make a few more runs. You know, and that's very comforting. People like that. Like, you know, when a cat purrs, the reason it purrs partly is the vibration helps its bones repair themselves. Like, it actually helps bones knit that slight vibration. That's what Andrew McDonald's voice does, and that's what Daniel Vettori's voice does. It will heal injuries faster.
I thought you were about to break into an Andrew Wu there, another man with a deep, reassuring voice. We're bouncing around a bit here today, but bear with us. I mentioned we'd touch on the various England injuries. Since we last recorded, Jofra Archer has been ruled out for the season. Matt Fisher's been ruled out for the season. Saqib Mahmood was ruled out before we recorded last week, but that's three additional stress fractures which have ended three more seasons. There's a theory doing the rounds, and the ECB's own medical staff have pushed us along a bit,
three
which is
seasons
a little
in
bit
one
unusual. That this is to do with COVID lockdowns and bone density. I haven't got the stats in front of me, but in effect, that if you ask a professional athlete to sit still for, you know, 2 months, 3 months, I think it was 4 months initially here, and not do what they normally would do. Of course, they weren't able to net as such when we're in lockdown here through 2020, that you lose quite a significant chunk of your bone density. And when you're at that elite level, that is, it's not about, you know, running around the block. It's about people who rely on pushing their body to the extreme as fast bowlers do. And that what we're seeing here now is a couple of years later, when they've been using their back to bowl again, that they've not been able to do it with quite the same strength, and thus they're suffering these injuries. So, I mean, I can't for a moment profess to know much about this, but it has some degree of logical narrative to it.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of things do, though, when you can point out causative things, correlative things that might be causative.
Yep.
We are not doctors. Maybe we should call Dr. Monique Ryan and say, look, you know, you seem to know about things. Tell us about bone density. Tell us about the likelihood of that becoming a problem over a couple of years of watching Netflix and smashing your fish tank accidentally. I don't know. But it's a horrible thing. I keep thinking, you know, I remember back to Lords at 2019, the Archer-Smith day, and when we were recording, and, you know, we were saying this is someone who could be shaping fast bowling for the next 10 years because of like how exciting it was the way he'd bowled that day. And it's just every injury, every weight, every setback, it just, I don't know, it just feels like someone running along with a bag of gold doubloons with a hole in the bottom, and like the treasure is slowly trickling away with each week and each month that goes by.
Yeah, look, he's 27, so he still, at least theoretically, has his best fast bowling ahead of him if you work on the basis that fast bowlers are at their absolute best from about 29 to 32. But another year out of the game, it's going to be tough for him. I suppose he could end up being a white ball only type like Tamal Mills when he had all of those back problems. I hope it doesn't play out that way, because I still subscribe to what I said then in 2019 that that Archer at his best is the most transformative cricketer of his generation, or could have been almost at this point. But that 2019, everything he seemingly touched turned to gold, and let's hope he comes back. I think that was the prevailing feeling when that news came through. People were just like, the wind came out of your sails. I was at Lord's doing the first day of that Middlesex Durham game, and everybody you spoke to was like, oh, did you hear the Joffrey news? Oh, like, it's not about even seeing England do well. No one's viewing it through a parochial lens, and no one expected him to play international cricket this year anyway. It's just like that visceral experience of watching Archer, and that will be denied that at least until next year, it would seem. And what it has done with all the other fast bowlers out of contention, so Ollie Robinson isn't yet ready to roll as a test player again. We saw him bowling off spin last week, you know. I think my theory is that Ollie Robinson might end up...
In shades?
He did. I've got a theory that Ollie Robinson's going to become an outstanding off spinner when he's older, a la Tony Gregg. Anyway, for another day, Chris Wokes isn't fit to play at the moment. So, and you add, obviously, Mark Wood, who I think will play some short form cricket in July or August on his comeback.
Yep.
He might play test cricket against South Africa, but that's a best case scenario. Ollie Stone's still missing from the injury he picked up last year to his back. So with all of these players missing, it's given the opportunity to like Matty Potts from Durham, who, if you're drawing up a depth chart 12 months ago on all of the fast bowlers who might play for England, he might have been like the 24th bowler picked. And that's no reflection on Potts. It's just that he just wasn't anywhere near the conversation. And he's so in the frame now that they rested him, Durham, last week at Lord's, knowing that he's probably going to make his test debut in 9 days from now at Lord's alongside Broad and Anderson. What an extraordinary story.
Well, if there were a reflection on Potts, then they wouldn't be calling the kettle black any longer. But I kind of like the Matthew Potts story because he's just someone I'd almost never heard of. I was like, your name's vaguely familiar, you know, in the world of county cricket that you pay closer attention to than I do. And I do my best. It's not like I don't try, but there are 4,000 players across all of the teams. Like, how are you supposed to know them all? But, you know, saw a bit of vision. He seemed to bowl pretty nicely. But, yeah, the idea, as you say, a few months ago that he would have been rolling up to complete the trio would have been considered fanciful.
Yeah, he's a good cricketer. We've seen enough of that this year. While we're talking county cricket, let's skip through that last group of four-day games that were played before the blast break. They're not back
playing. Yeah, it's the last round. It's the last drinks. They're playing Kaysan, and then they're going to put the lights up for county cricket, and everyone has to go off and go home and play T20 for a few
Yeah, they're going to play Don't Look Back in Anger if it were a nightclub here. Last song of the night. Division 1, Surrey, Hampshire, Yorkshire, Lancs are the top four heading into the break for Yorkshire. They played Warwickshire at Headingley. Adam Lyth made 100. Harry Brook made 82 after being brought into the test squad. But other than that, it was a fairly pedestrian draw. Just one win for Warwickshire after winning the comp last year. Hampshire defeated Somerset in 3 days. They bowled them out for 211 and 69. Somerset's batting's been dross this year with a couple of exceptions. Although, if you're up against Keith Barker, Kyle Abbott, Muhammad Abbas, I mean, good luck. That is just too good. They should not be allowed to play together, those three. They are just too good. They're second in Division 1. I think they'll end up winning a comp. It'll be huge when they play Surrey for a second time. At Wantage Road...
Keith Barker was the one doing the ridiculous stuff in that game last year, wasn't he? And maybe it was the last game of the season
The last time we might have talked about Keith Barker was when he hit 8 sixes into the mound stand against Middlesex to change a game that was going in a different direction a couple of years ago.
Wasn't he taking wickets when Hampshire were
he took a seven for at the end. I mean, he's got more than 400 first class wickets and more than 4,000 first class runs. They're probably both closer to having fives in front of them now. So he's a super cricketer. Nearly played Premier League football as a striker. So he's a capable all round athlete. Yep. At Wantage Road, Ben Compton made another century and then 68 in the second dig. He's overtaken all of them. He overtook Shah Masood, Chiteshwar Pujara, Dixon from Durham, who was out injured with a hamstring problem this week. He ended up the closest to 1,000. I think Compton got to about 850, the sad postscript with Shah Masood. I'll come to when we reach the second division. But yes, for Kent, He got them up to 519 for nine. There was a high-scoring draw in that match against Northants. A couple of timely half-centuries for Zach Crawley, who it was fair to say that County fans weren't thrilled that Crawley got picked for the Test team, having made not a run for 6 weeks. And, you know, players like Sam Robson missed out. But, yes, they're playing the long game with Crawley, I suppose. Over at Old Trafford, Essex made 391 in the first innings, and Dan Lawrence made 120 after being left out of that first Test squad. Up against Jimmy Anderson, which can only help in terms of his reputation. Anderson took one for 59 from 21. Then Lakes were bowled out twice in a hurry for 103 and then 232, following on a combination of Cook, Porter and Harmer. And Essex got the job done by an innings and 56 runs. And very quickly in Division 2, the game I was doing at Lords, Durham made 350. Middlesex replied with 422. And then Toby Rowland-Jones completely blew the game open. I mean, it was beautiful, Jeff. Toby Rowland-Jones, who has had so many injuries, you know, we talk about back stress fractures. He would have been on that Ashes tour of 17-18, if not for getting one in the final game of the county season. He's had a shoulder reco. He's had a knee reco. I mean, everything, right? And he's back now. He's not bowling 85 mile an hour anymore, but he's still a pretty bloody good bowler. He picked up 10 for the match. Got Stokes out second ball for a duck in the second innings, which was pretty cool that Roland Jones was able to get the Test captain out in his last performance before he moves to Test duty. And Middlesex stay top of the table. Notts had an emphatic 10-wicket victory over Derbyshire. And this is the disappointing bit here. Sean Massoud, he was out for 18 in the first innings to Paddo, remembering that he needed about 160 runs, was it, Jeff? 160-odd to reach 1,000 before the end of May. And then Broad got him.
Maybe.
So 18 in the first dig to Paddo. Then the second innings, third ball, Broad celebra peel, given out league before wicket. It wasn't out.
No.
I mean, Sean Massoud pretty much walked, so he didn't help the situation. But I watched it back a few times. That was hitting outside the line. Broad was over celebrating with third slip before the finger even went up. So, yes. Not a great way to end that particular storyline. But, yeah, a convincing win for Notts in that game, with Haseeb Ahmed making 93 not out in the second innings. I think they chased down 167 without losing a wicket. And the final game, Worcestershire. Jeff, you're one of the counties that you always get confused about. They're having a great season. They have pumped Leicestershire in 3 days at New Road. They went huge in their first innings with Azhar Ali making 225, the Pakistani veteran. And then they won by an innings and 259. So Worcestershire right up there with Notts and Middlesex in the race for promotion out of Division 2.
I see. Everybody wants a promotion. Well, plenty to keep you busy there. There was also a bit of Test cricket going on, Bangladesh and Sri Lanka, which we missed talking about last week. And kind of, I mean, honestly, it was half deliberate. Like, I didn't remind you because it was a bat-a-thon, you know. Yeah. They didn't even get into the fourth innings at Chittagong. It was heartening to see Angelo Matthews make some big runs, and then somewhat disheartening that he got out for 199. Not many players have done that. Angelo did that, but he's at least churning out some runs again. And then Mushfiqur Rahim and Tamim Iqbal making centuries as well. So, you know, one for the batters, and then the second test at Dhaka is underway with both the same and a completely different kind of approach, because it is one of the most bananas scorecards I have ever seen in my cricket life. Mushfiqur 175, Litton Das 141, six ducks littered around them. Only one other player got to double figures, and that was a score of 15. So you've got 15, a 9, a 6, and everybody else has made noughts. It is extraordinary. So two big tons, and they got 365 all together. So pretty extraordinary. They were 5 down for 24 at one point before that big partnership rescued them. And so, yeah, that game's still underway.
Yeah, imagine that. You're the Sri Lankan bowling lineup. You've got them 24 for 5 on the first morning at the National Stadium in Dhaka, and you're still fielding a day and a half later, galling. And Mushfiqur, back-to-back hundreds for the great man, so pleased to see that for him, the former captain of Bangladesh. And, yeah, maybe they can get a result out of that and win the series 1-0. Jeff, before we go to our interview, let's do a little bit of
a Nerd Pledge. Nerd Pledge, yes. It's the game we play on the final word, the game we play with the people who listen to this show, the reverse quiz. Here's how it works. They fund the show, the people who listen and choose to do this, by sending us contributions, but they're not a normal number. They're a very specific number because that number relates to cricket in some way, and we have to work out what that relationship is. Our No Pledger this week is Big Ben Halliwell, who I run into all the time around the towns of Carlton and Brunswick. He has sent through $4.40 in AUD. So 440 is our number in some form.
And he sent a clue through with it. This number occurred in the 1990s and it happened in a match that had a very odd and unique occurrence, which I have never seen or heard of before or since.
This sounds like very No Pledger areas, Ben. Thank you. Look, so the first thing that came to mind was I was like, didn't Dean Headley take 4 for 40 on that tour at the end of the 90s? And I thought, was it to do with the win in Melbourne? And so I looked it up and it wasn't. It was in Sydney in the next test, which was a match that Australia won. So it wasn't the Headley moment, because I did think that in referring to a very odd and unique occurrence that could have been England winning a test match in Australia, as they did in Melbourne famously on that particular tour. But the Sydney test, they didn't win, but it was still a match with a lot of pretty random, weird shit that happened in it. Mark Taylor's last test match, Glenn McGrath's 200th wicket, Mark Waugh's 100th catch. Mark Taylor takes his 157th catch to take the record off Alan Border for the most test catches. Rahul Dravid holds it now, but that was a big deal then in the first week of 1999. First innings, you nearly get both Waugh brothers making tons together. Steve Waugh gets out for 96, didn't make up for the silver medal. And what you could say was an odd, unique occurrence since then, not before then, but since then, was that Australia picked three spinners playing at home. Pretty certain that hasn't happened since. It happened in the 30s.
I think they did it one more time when Funky was around, possibly the next year against the West Indies. I mean, right. It was when Funky was bowling seam up for 4 or 5 overs with the new ball and then reverting to spin later in the match.
Yeah. Now, the West Indies game was when Funky went Federation Blue with the hair.
McGill and Funky played and Warne didn't. Warne wasn't around that summer.
Warne was injured for some reason. Yeah. He had his finger problem or something like that. So, Warne McGill and Colin Miller all played together as three spinners. Warne was coming back from injury, took a 1 for as McGill took a 5 for. So that was kind of cute.
It was memorable that Warne came back, and like I'll never forget the sort of the hype around Warne playing that test match. Because remember, he was pretty banged up and he gets Butch stumped, I reckon, in the first innings. And the response.
No, LBW, I think.
LBW. So I think there might have been a stumped in the second innings. Either way, there was a lot. Put it this way, the ratings on television would have been astronomical when Warne was bowling that spell. Mm-hmm. It was late in the afternoon and everyone was just willing him to be better after having had that shoulder problem.
Yep. So first innings, you've got the Waugh brothers thing. Second innings, you've got McGill taking 5 and Warne taking 1 on the comeback. Third innings, Australia have a 102-run lead. You've got the bit where Michael Slater was run out by Dean Headley, but the third umpire's view was blocked on the replay, and so they didn't give it out. Even though he couldn't have been anything but out, you couldn't actually see that he was out. So he gets reprieved. Then he nearly breaks the Bannerman. He makes 123 out of 184, just cutting sick at the end. And as we know, that ends up at 66.84% of the runs behind Bannerman on 67.35, which we've talked about all the time, is that Slater's second on the list. But I think what we haven't talked about is that he nearly got it. So Slater doesn't bat through. He doesn't carry his bat through the innings. He's not even last man out. He's the eighth wicket to fall. So there's two more to follow after him. At the point that he gets out, the score is 180. That's 68.33%. He's got the Bannerman at that point. Now, Stuart McGill makes one more run at that point. McGill's batting 9 in this team, by the way, like God knows how. But McGill makes one more run. He's out for 6. And McGrath gets out for a duck, which cumulatively should still give Slater the record at 67.95. But in the interim, Funky Miller has made 3 not out, and thus he saves the Bannerman. After Slater's got out, he pinches the record off him and makes sure that Bannerman remains.
Had the bat out, so here I come to save the day.
Did it.
Now on parade. They say it's the only way. Bad day. The only one that is there. Sorry.
When you're the third spinner, you can't sing Second Solution. That's the only problem.
Oh, wow. They're very good.
So I love that now in retrospect because, you know, I'm glad Michael Slater doesn't have that record and Colin Miller is what stood between us and that. And if all that's not enough, in the fourth innings, England are chasing 287. They have a crack. McGill takes 7 for 50 and both openers get stumped. As you remember, there's one for Warren, but there's one for McGill. So Butcher and Stewart both get stumped by Healy, right? And I thought this could be something Ben has never seen before or since, because the only way you would have seen it before is if you'd been watching the Ashes in 1882 or 1886, in which this happened both those years, England on the receiving end from Australia via Jack Blackham and James Kelly, not the Geelong Football Club halfback flanker, but the wicketkeeper. And then there was one more instance against England from Clyde Walcott in 1950. So that's, you know, three times in the first 120-plus years of Test cricket. And there have been a couple since, but you've got Ridham and Sahar against Bangladesh and Niroshan Dikweller against South Africa. So six times in total in Test cricket history that both openers have been stumped. And what's really interesting is the pairs of spinners who've done it. So some prestigious pairs. Warren and McGill did it. Ramadan and Valentine did it. Ashwin and Harbhajan Singh did it. Rangana Herath and Dilrawan Pereira did it. Dilrawan not quite on the same level there, but still, Herath's in there. And then in 1882, in a match that started in 1881, you'll like that, Adam, started on New Year's Eve and then spilled over into the next year. The bowlers were Billy Cooper, not the trumpeter, but William Cooper, the leg break bowler, and Joey Palmer and his five daughters who got the other one. So there's only ever been one bowler to get both the stumpings. So there have been six lots of two stumpings, both openers stumped, but only one bowler's got both of them out.
Yep.
And that was in 1896, the great Australian all-rounder, Harry Trott, who, in final word, form, knocked over W.G. Grace and the inexhaustible A.E. Studder, both stumped, to start off a test match. How about that?
Oh, that's fabulous. I mean, you can... Old AE was just keen to just keep moving from the night before, still dancing, still tiptoeing around. And
also, just a little thing I noted from tuning into our electoral talk earlier about fairness in society, and that's something that comes up in Tim Wigmore's book as well. How do you like this condescending line from the Wisden obituary for Harry Trott? By sheer force of character, he overcame the disadvantages involved in lack of education and won the warm regard of men with whom, apart from the comradeship of the cricket field, he had nothing in common. Ah, like odious skunks. They're like, oh, look, he was a poor one. He spoke with a funny voice, but he was good at cricket, so even proper real gentleman humans condescended to like him a bit. Fuck off, you posh pricks.
More story time on the weekend show. Hey, Jeff, time for us to take a break. When we return, we'll be having a conversation with Stefan Samansky and Tim Wigmore about their book, Cricketomics.
This is Jeremy Coney, and I'm on the final word.
Hey, guys, we haven't said this in a few weeks. Buy a cricket bat. Make it Woodstock. Woodstock Cricket. .co.uk, TFW20, bung it in, 20% off, best bat in England, probably the best bat in the world. Why wouldn't ya?
If you want a wood stick, make it a wood stock. That's what I say in the slogan that I just made up. Is it good? Not necessarily. Have people been paid for worse? Probably. I mean, almost certainly. Look, it's no call carpet call the experts in the trade, but Woodstock... Look, there was a competition about which cricket bats are the best ones. A blind test. No one knew what the bats were. Woodstock won number one and number two. They've got the two best bats in the world. They're much more affordable than most other cricket companies as well. And you add 20% off from that because you're friends with us.
And call Uber Bill on 13 13 32. No, actually, call Woodstock Cricket.
That's 13 13 32.
Woodstockcricket.co.uk, TFW20, buy yourself a bat. Spoil yourself. I'm going to use one at Lord's when I play there on the 15th of June. I'll tell you more about that on Storytime, eh? Until then.
Now I'm just thinking about Lubemobile. Yeah, it just sounds like something that a really gross dude would call his car. You know, welcome to the Lubemobile. Anyway, go buy a cricket bat. Stop thinking about that.
This is The Final Word with Adam Collins and Jeff Lemon. In my hand, I have a copy of Cricketomics, The Anatomy of Modern Cricket, written by Stefan Samansky and Tim Wigmore, who we've got on the line. Good afternoon to you both.
Good afternoon. Hi. Good to be with you.
Hi, guys. Good to be back.
Stefan, let's start with you. You're the illustrious award-winning author of Soconomics. I've seen your name before. How did you transition from writing about the economics of football, soccer, to cricket? As simple as that. Are you a cricket fan as well, or was this just you saw a sport that was crying out for a book like this?
Yeah, no, I've always watched cricket. It was I was terrible at school at every sport, but this was the one I would really have loved to have been good at. I wasn't. I can't bat, bowl, or field. But I was always followed the sport, and very glad to be able to write something about it, because there's very little written about it by academics. It's actually kind of under-researched topic. But to write this kind of book, you need the right journalist who can talk about what's really going on in the game. And that's when teaming up with Tim was the thing that made this happen. Without that, it just wouldn't have been possible.
I know Tim Wigmore pretty well, so does Jeff. And I'm tipping he would have been bombarding you with WhatsApps and emails saying, hey, Stefan, let's write a book together. Is it something like that?
Well, we actually had a little dispute, and I'm getting so old now, I think my memory's failing. We have both claimed at various points that we were the ones who came up with the idea, but since Tim's a lot younger, I'll concede to him, since who knows? I don't know what it did yesterday.
Yeah, the origin story's got lost somewhere along the way, which is, I guess, just like a lot of cricket history, so it's kind of fitting, right?
Tim, cricket is a sport that's very, it's rich with mythology in terms of the kind of mythology around, you know, people making up reasons for things, truisms. Oh, this is happening because of X, Y, and Z. England are bad at batting because they play too much cricket in April or whatever it is. Was this like an exciting opportunity for, and I know the kind of things that excite you, they are these sort of questions, to get in there and prove or disprove things by applying hard data to the accepted truths?
So I think often something happens and then we kind of work backwards and we're like, oh, it happened because of this. And actually, if you look, often you end up with completely contradictory reasons. You know, over a few year period, it's very easy to just blame it on the latest fad or whatever. You know, say, oh, whatever, is T20, has it destroyed batting techniques in Test cricket? And then you'll get a guy like Ben Stokes at Headingley, and be like, oh, T20 made him be able to do this innings. And the other, that kind of classic contradictory reasoning. So actually, yeah, to kind of, you're right, to actually be able to take a step back and to kind of work through what's actually happening and why. And obviously, this is something I couldn't have done without Stefan and his book with Simon Cooper. Soconomics is obviously fantastic and sort of really quite a seminal book in probably sports writing. And so to be able to team up with him was great, and hopefully apply some of those techniques to cricket. And yeah, as you said, try and look a little bit beyond the kind of fables and the myths and to work out what's actually going on. Starting with the very age-old question of basically why batsmen and bowlers have different backgrounds generally.
Yeah, and I mean, this isn't your first rodeo in this space either, Tim, from Cricket 2.0 that was, multi-award winning book with Freddie Wild a couple of years ago. And that also had that almost, I suppose, Gladwellian interest in answering questions that seem like, as Jeff put it, like where the accepted wisdom hasn't been challenged, I suppose. And where you lead off is interesting, about the very idea of private schools and state schools and batters versus bowlers and who does what and why there are these misconceptions. But some of these myths actually are borne out by the data. Can you explain a bit about that and why you led off with that topic?
Yeah, it's probably like sometimes a bit like this, you get lucky, or maybe you make your own luck, but maybe you just do get lucky. And this is probably a chapter that's more kind of relevant in the aftermath of the Ashes. And, you know, it's provoked one of those big kind of English cricket loves its kind of angst-ridden kind of moments of, you know, where's it all gone wrong? And, you know, the Ashes was a classic where actually for the first time really actually looking at, you know, maybe the player pool is too small in terms of, you know, the backgrounds of players. And so that's made the sort of first chapter more relevant. So yeah, it's basically looking at, so the traditional idea of kind of batsmen and bowlers, you know, to go all the way back is that, you know, you, Adam, you would own your land and you would employ Jeff and other labourers to bowl at you, because bowling is tough and it's physically tough. It's not as glamorous as hitting the ball. You don't get that kind of easy release. It's just a more difficult, more arduous thing. And so you had the idea that the then gentlemen, who were the amateurs, would tend to be batsmen. an off the county cricket, often the captains as well, and then the professionals would be the bowlers. You know, stereotypically from the mines, that's obviously a bit exaggerated, but there's also something in that. Anyway, you go, you trace this all the way, and then even today, you still have the batsmen ring are significantly more likely to come from private schools than bowlers. So this traditional idea somehow still seems to hold true today. And actually, trying to unpick why that is very interesting. And we basically think that if you think of nature and nurture, generally nurture is a little bit more important on the batting side, i.e., you know, good coaching, you should be able to net a lot, having people to bowl at you, practice, and nature, i.e., you know, your kind of raw talent is a little bit more important on the bowling side, which seems to go some way to explain this disparity between batting and bowling, and why the backgrounds are still probably not that, you know, kind of almost as someone in the 19th century would have, if you had to put them into cricket now, that would probably be one of the things that surprised them the least, seeing how this traditional divide is broadly still true, and obviously lots of exceptions, but broadly is still true.
One of the things that interested me, Stefan, was the way that the human element of things can be particularly important in amongst the data and the analysis. So, like in with what Tim's talking about there, you do a lot of quantifying about the kind of facilities that kids get access to at private schools, the numbers in terms of the proportion of batting players and the kind of the scores they can make, the fact they play on better batting pitches and so on. But then there are the unquantifiable things like a kid who's learning batting from a batting coach at a private school has better networking opportunities because that coach is going to be connected. That coach is probably an ex-county pro. That coach has contacts. And through that, a student with that privileged start is able to access the world of county cricket much more easily. It's much less far away. It's much more approachable. You can't put any sort of numbers on things like that, but those illustrative human moments tell a lot.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And I mean, one of the points about this is it shows just how, as Tim was saying, how little Britain has changed in 200 years, and how these class sort of based systems still persist. But one of the things that I found most interesting was the way in which these things, if you're not careful, you can miss this stuff. So yes, batting in an English school between the ages of 13 and 18 is a really big advantage. But you'd think that being a bowler between the ages of 16 and 18 in one of these schools might be a big advantage, but it doesn't seem to show up. But then if you look at the England under 19 cricket team, by the time they get to that point of selection, the England selectors seem to be able to select almost all the players who go on to be really successful test and one-day internationals. So it's also striking that, I think there's more work to do on this, that these moments of development are really quite sudden and sharp. And so I think there's more to say. And that's, again, where human intervention makes a difference. If everything depends on just a small difference here or there, then there's always scope for humans to step in and make a real difference. So I think there's more research, but I think it's also kind of interesting to think about how this affects the way coaching practice works.
And interesting with bowlers, even though at England under 19 level is the case study you provide, but it's the batters you could probably pick when they're 14 because they're technicians, so to speak. They're being given these opportunities. Whereas with bowlers, it's more that nature point that Tim makes, where they have their growth spurt a little bit later, they end up 6'4" and can bowl as quickly as they can bowl, and that ends up being a bigger input for selection than accuracy. It's what your natural gifts are. What's your ceiling look like with pace?
And something else is sort of interesting that's happening here is that for the private schools themselves, these players are basically, they are marketing investments. And by that, I mean, if you give a sports scholarship to Joe Root, then you can say forever, we made Joe Root. The interesting question is, it's obviously very hard to disentangle, how much did a school make Joe Root work? He was 15. So actually, we classify him as, so our data, we classify him as state educated. So we're saying, where did you spend the majority of your secondary education? Because clearly, if at 16, you can predict pretty well, and therefore it's kind of a marketing thing to give someone a scholarship and say, we made them. So what's interesting is that even getting on at 13 or going to, or even earlier, that still is a big advantage. But from a point of view, I mean, these private schools, they are they're not, they do have charitable status, but they are basically businesses. And in terms of as an investment, actually, you would always give, it's a safer investment always to give it, to give a scholarship to a batsman than a bowler, because a batsman is less likely to break down and be injured, and it's easier to predict at an earlier age. So something is happening kind of earlier in the system, which, yeah, so there's lots of things going on. It's hard to disentangle. And obviously, yeah, the school helps to make the players, but they also try and claim credit sometimes more than they deserve as well, because, yeah, they want to promote themselves as well.
In terms of the topics you two cover in the book, it's much more broad than looking at the sort of topics we've covered so far. There are lots of different things. There's Steve Waugh's test team and the way that their scoring rates changed test cricket. There's how New Zealand managed to become as competitive as they are. There's Sri Lanka's competitiveness in the 90s. There's data, a lot of data about domestic competitions and the balance they have with international matches and the way that boards arrange them. Like you've gone through all these different subjects in the whole sport. How did you come up with what you wanted to focus on? Was it like a word cloud kind of idea? Did you like sit there and brainstorm and throw darts at balloons, or like were these pet topics that you know, each of you had a few things that you really wanted to do X, Y, and Z?
Yeah, I think it was a bit of both. So I think there were some things that were obvious that you would obviously want to talk about. So the impact of T20 on test cricket and so forth. I mean, we started off, I think, thinking, oh, well, it must have been the case that scoring rates went up in test cricket after the adoption of the IPL. So after adoption of T20. So we thought we just went through the data and looking, expecting, yeah, we'll see that. And then bang, no, actually, that's not what happened. It's the strike rates go up well before T20 starts. And so sometimes chapters came out of those sort of searching for something that seemed obvious and then not finding it. And then others, I think, were more, yeah, I mean, so there were pet peeves. So, I mean, Tim's had already done a lot of work on concussion, and so that was something that got him interested in that. And, you know, I'm obviously interested in statistics, so there had to be a chapter on Duckworth Lewis. I mean, that couldn't not happen, right?
In terms of unexpected chapters or unexpected conclusions, Tim, I think you and I thrashed this out. I mean, I didn't know you were working on this project especially, but you put to me a couple of cricketers and you wanted to know their scholastic background in Australia and my theories on private-public or government-private education in Australia and how the test team's comprised and thought of. When you go through it, you present a fairly compelling case that everything that I thought is kind of wrong. Do you want to elaborate on that when it comes to the schooling backgrounds of Australian cricketers?
Well, like I said, that Australia is probably a more egalitarian country than Britain, but it's not as much more egalitarian as it likes to present. And I think this is one reason why this probably annoys a lot of Aussies. And there was an amazing headline when Ed Cowan, when he scored a test century, saying, you know, Cowan smashes through the private school barrier, suggesting that actually going to an elite school is actually a disadvantage for him. And there are all these theories about this in terms of, you know, New South Wales kids at private schools not being able to play in club cricket and stuff. All, you know, very compelling theories, like we talked about at the start. And then we got into the data, and clearly there's some differences. You know, far more people go to private schools in Australia than England. There's also sort of different categories of private schools. There's sort of more traditional British ones, and there's kind of Catholic schools, which often the fees are pretty modest often. But we're looking at it, and there's been a shift over time where private schools did used to be underrepresented in terms of the amount of Australian cricketers they produce. Now they produce a clearly disproportionate number. And if you dig a bit more into it, it actually is often the very elite schools. Pat Cummins and Cameron Green are two players who went to those who are producing a lot of the players. So it's not as extreme as England. We're not saying that for a moment, but it's less different to England than I think a lot of Australians would think. And yeah, I think the numbers, we were very careful about, well, particularly careful in this chapter, almost because we knew it was kind of going against the grain. But yeah, I think we'd be able to find something that is a shift over time. And yeah, the private schools are a huge, huge factory of talent in England. And they're also a very significant producer of talent in Australia.
Well, the raw numbers that you were coming up with were that the numbers are basically the same in terms of percentages of, you know, players from private school backgrounds who play for the national teams.
But it's less disproportionate in Australia because more people in Australia go to private schools, but it still is disproportionate in Australia.
But it's evolved too though, right, Tim? So the issue, yeah. I mean, the issue, that's probably the wrong descriptor, but how pronounced this is, hasn't, it's a pretty modern phenomenon, isn't it? Like you go back, you went back through the years and you did the graphs on this, and it's not as though 30 years ago loads of Australian Test cricketers went to fee-paying schools. It's a more modern thing than that.
But bear in mind also that 30 years ago, many fewer Australians went to private schools as well. So there's been a shift there. And that's one thing that's different between the UK and Australia, is that there have been very big shifts in the education system in Australia. And actually, in the UK, in terms of, it's been about 8% of kids go to private schools for the last, well, since the Second World War, more or less, almost 100 years now. So that's one difference. And the share of privately educated kids in the Australian team has more or less followed that that trend. I mean, the other thing to say is that one thing that came out in writing the book, because we started doing this, we started saying, well, now we need to look at Sri Lankan schools, and then we'll be able to look at Indian schools, and now we're going to look at Barbadian schools. And one thing that comes out is, you know, the British style of education, which handed out to the former colonists, is actually made a huge difference. And I mean, I think, again, it's something that more work needs to be done on. I think it's just so, it's been that whole nature of this, the way in which you're schooled has had such a big impact on the playing of cricket. And again, maybe that's an obvious point in retrospect, but it's something that comes out when you start to dig into the data and see just how many of these players come from schools built on the British model is quite remarkable.
And then that ties into the kind of analysis that you do on India in terms of the, well, you're talking about an Australian mythology of all players coming from state schools, but then in India it's a mythology of the countryside and the sort of rural roots of cricket, when in fact the analysis that you're doing paints it as an almost exclusively urban game, and the bigger the city, the more influence it has.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about cricket is that everywhere it has a bit of a rural myth tied to it. And as in most myths, there's usually something to it. So in England and Australia and the West Indies, you could find examples of these kind of rural clubs that have, that play a disproportionate role in people's minds and gives you this idea. But in India, there's almost no history of rural cricket, whatever. And it's a remarkably urban sport. And one thing I would argue as an economist is that pretty much all sport is urban, really. All professional sport is urban. And the reason it's urban is because to play sport, you need professional sport, two things. You need opponents and you need fans. And cities are where you're going to find opponents and fans that are in close enough proximity to make it worthwhile. And so that's why sport is generally urban. But in India, it's incredibly pronounced. And really, but the sort of question we try to sort of set ourselves in that chapter is to try to decide whether in the future it's going to, where will India's talent come from? Will they finally tap into their rural talent, or will they continue, or will they actually start to develop more talent from the urban slums, which are absolutely vast? And you can see a case for both, but I think it does represent, India is still remaining one of the most rural countries in the world. There's a big issue of tapping into their talent.
And the shift in Indian talent pool, well, India has opened up its talent pool, but this has not been, there's a few exceptions, and that's Ranjan is one, this has generally not been, you know, to kids from villages, it's been to kids from, in India terms, small cities to, you know, actually cities often of several million people. You know, Ranchi, MS Dhoni's home, it's, you know, city of a million people and stuff. So what has changed, and what I argue is a big reason for India's rise, is India used to basically get almost all its test players from the big six states. And now that share has decreased. So it seems to be, it's still getting almost all its players from cities, but the share of cities has become a bit more even. So it has opened up its talent pool. But as Stefan said, if you're a kid from a village in India, it's still phenomenally, phenomenally difficult to get anywhere near the test team.
Yeah, it's interesting that you talk about the myth that when India won in Australia last year with a third 11, it was so
amazing,
much
yeah.
devoted to, oh, well, they've scoured every corner of India. Harsha Bogle, colleague and friend of ours, has advanced this view that if you are willing to go out and do the hard work, you can find players from anywhere and you can have a deeper talent pool. Maybe it's generation one of that, and that'll expand. And that brings me to, I suppose, the interesting chapter you have on city versus city against country versus country. And, you know, obviously there's the IPL that's done the former. And when Australia had their revolution, World Series cricket, that they went with state against state, mate against mate, and, you know, as it were, and they stuck with the fairly formulaic idea of what cricket rivalry would be. Come on, Aussie, come on, as you use off the top as your intro to that chapter. Maybe Kerry Packer would have been better served saying, hang on a second, let's play off Melbourne against Sydney and try and open up those markets and do as the IPL kind of has done a generation later.
Yeah, I think that's really, there doesn't seem to be, we talked to Gideon Hay, who was kind of, who's written the definitive book of World Series cricket, and he said that there was no evidence that it was really seriously contemplated at all. But there's a kind of really interesting counterfactual. If Packer had actually torn up, said international cricket doesn't particularly work, we're going to do something completely different. And yeah, have Melbourne be Sydney, maybe have a couple of teams in Melbourne, you know, Adelaide and so on, Brisbane. And you put Joel Garner playing for Brisbane and you have Michael Holding playing for Sydney and stuff. And that, yeah, it's fascinating kind of counterfactual if he'd attempted that, but he didn't. He basically just tries to replicate the structures of international cricket. And it takes, of course, 1996 is another starting doors moment when Lalit Modi, he tries to introduce the IPL, but for 50 over cricket, and that plan gets rejected. So that plan is for 8 cities, very much like what the IPL is, to play 50 over cricket. And that doesn't happen. And then it takes another 12 years until we get the real IPL. So there's a few moments along the way. And clearly, with international cricket, the number of kind of elite countries has always been fairly small, and for the bigger markets, if you can find a way to monetize city v city, it's going to be way more lucrative, because you can play 60 IPL games in a month, and India can only play what, sort of half on 15 days if they had a packed month. So but basically the shift which we're seeing, I think, is clearly borne out in the data, is if you think of football as a model, which is you have international tournaments, which are huge and actually probably the biggest single events in the sport, but the kind of beating heart of the sport, the day-to-day interest is centered around the club game. And then you have what cricket has been traditionally, which is really miles away from that, international cricket being everything. Cricket is on a journey to being more towards football, whether it ends up at the football level, not necessarily, but international cricket is becoming a smaller part of the ecosystem, which is obviously the IPL's part of that. It's also why the 100 was created, really. The ECB, they said basically they were worried about international cricket is not a regular lucrative source of cash, because we don't have India or Australia coming. We're not going to be earning a huge amount. So the idea was you can have a tournament where you make money every year reliably, no matter who is coming. And that's a kind of a shift underway. So club cricket is becoming an ever more important part of the game.
You mentioned Duckworth Lewis, Steph, and I thought that was the most impressive part of the book for me, is that you actually made me understand Duckworth Lewis, which I've never understood. Not that I could sit down and do the calculation mid-game, but I understand the principle of what it is trying to achieve and how it does it. And what really stood out was that you pointed out that almost nobody who follows or watches the game understands how it works, but that we don't actually care because it feels right. Like, because the results that it comes up with feel intuitive to the average cricket watcher. You know, it seems to hit the right balance, however it does it. And it seems like, I mean, that must be the most rewarding sort of feeling as a mathematician to come up with a model, with a predictive model or an adaptive model like that, that consistently gets the intuitively right result from a human side as well as a technical side.
Absolutely. It is a remarkable invention, and it's quite staggering that, as you say, I mean, the vast majority of people don't understand it, but almost nobody argues with it. And if you think about that, I mean, the things that people did understand in the past, they caused immense arguments when it was average run rate or, you know, the various other mechanisms that have been created. Just as a statistician, I cannot think of any other sport where a statistical rule is written into the game. It's not a strategy. It's not analytics. It's not Moneyball. It's how you play this game, and that, I think, that's just an amazing sport.
Tim, I can see your fingerprints all over the New Zealand chapter with reference to how they've been able to do more with less by any objective measure. You sort of found, I think, about 8 reasons why, which is going to be hard to surmise in one answer. But if I was to conclude what I read from it, it's that they've accepted their limitations and played within their limitations and played to their strengths. And can you elaborate a bit on how they've done that and why, therefore, they are so far, I guess, by proportion, ahead of the rest of the pack relative to other countries with much bigger populations?
So as you guys regularly talk about on this podcast, most cricket administration is pretty terrible. So it's a very low bar. But New Zealand's cricket administration is actually very, very good. It's actually claimed as amongst the best in any sport in the world. So it's got, basically, they got their old board to outvote itself, replacing a regional model with actually having the best people on the board. So that's a kind of starting block. So you're actually making decisions for the right reasons. And in terms of specifically what they've done, you know, a big part of it was they used to play their domestic cricket on, I think, 25 or so grounds a year. So you'd be playing at kind of local club grounds, and it was pretty, the facilities were substandard. And so in 2005, they introduced a warrant for fitness, basically with minimum standards of the grounds. And kind of linked to that, they sorted out their pitches. So pitches in New Zealand went from amongst the worst for batsmen to actually they've been since 2010, domestic cricket, they've been the best for batting in the world. And I think you basically, so they're more similar to the pitches you get in test cricket. They, unlike many countries, this is probably linked to the governance, they haven't burned money in their own T20 leagues. We've seen South Africa and various other countries losing huge amounts of money on T20 leagues, trying to kind of build their own IPL, which is pie in the sky. New Zealand haven't done that. They've also avoided what West Indies used to have, which was their kind of adversarial attitude towards T20 leagues, you know, like the IPL, costing them players. So they've avoided all that, which has been very smart. They've actually genuinely got a system which prioritises the international team above domestic cricket. Probably English cricket is an example where this generally is not the case. So we talked with Mike Hesson. There were some nice examples, like with BJ Watling. So BJ Watling was actually opening in domestic cricket, and he called up his coach and was like, "We want BJ Watling to be our new wicketkeeper. Can you move him down to five and make him the keeper?" And the coach did that, no problem. Same with Tom Latham before the World Cup. He was opening domestic cricket. They wanted him to bat at five and keep. And again, no problem. So the whole system is kind of geared towards the national team first. And a good example of that was 2008, they reduced their domestic schedule by a couple of rounds in order to fund more A-team cricket, which is obviously crucial as a bridge to the international game. So that the whole system really is geared towards what's best for the international game, and they found a way to basically kind of not have factions getting in the way of good decision making. Clearly, New Zealand has a lot of advantages; it's pretty rich, and I think culture there kind of works pretty easy, but I think crucially they've been able to use their small size to their advantage. So rather than trying to kind of ape Australia or whatever, it's all geared towards them and what they're doing. And in many ways, they've been able to learn from the best example of any small country exciting a sport, really, which is the All Blacks. So it's kind of the perfect template they've had on their front door. And the kind of the model of domestic teams to international teams is very similar to what it is with the Super Rugby and the All Blacks.
Yeah, very interesting. Look, there is so much here. I mean, there are six sections, there are 20 chapters, so we're not going to be able to touch on all of it. But I did, Stefan, before we go, wanted to talk about the 2018 series when India visited England. Now, you've gone on all sorts of different tangents in this book, and I've loved it. But I didn't really consider weather as one that would rear up, and so it does towards the end. Talk us through your theory about the 2018 series, which was an absolute belter, and how the weather might have been why India didn't end up taking home more success. They only won one test match.
Well, I mean, it's a standing joke in cricket that the weather matters, right? And we know. And certainly for the English, you know, sitting and playing cricket in 30 degrees is immensely demanding, whereas for tourists, having to play in Durham at 10 degrees is also a pretty horrendous prospect. So the issue is, can you quantify this? And that's a problem. But in fact, test cricket is a wonderful test bed for this. And it's not there are very few other sports where you could conduct a similar test. And the reason being is that you're playing the same game over several days. So in some sense, everything is the same on each day as far as the teams are concerned, apart from the weather. Now, what we did was we actually, you can download weather data from these US websites that are open source. And we got that for all the test cities for each day of the test matches going back to the 1930s, and then tried to see whether the difference in temperature between your home country for the visiting team and the actual temperature made a significant difference. And it turned out that it did. If the temperature difference was large enough between two countries with very different climates, then it would make a significant difference if it was significantly warmer or significantly colder. So, for example, For England and India, this makes a big difference because our climates are very different. But for Australia and South Africa, doesn't make a big difference because the climates are actually similar enough that there's no real temperature advantage. So we found, so specifically 2018, when the weather was pretty rubbish in England, this probably had a significant impact on the performance of the Indian team.
Well, the funny thing, Adam, you'll remember about that summit, it was baking hot in June and July, yes. Absolutely baking. Absolutely. And then as soon as the test series starts, the clouds come in and it gets about 15 degrees cooler. So the kind of counterfactual is if this series had been in June and July rather than August, given that I think it was one margin was 31 runs, other was 63. So two very tight games.
Yep.
And we'll be looking at Virat Kohli's legacy in a very, very different way.
I'm sure Indian fans who read this book will love hearing it put that way. There are chapters here around efficiency, around a day at the cricket, the Barmy Army, Afghanistan, Germany, the works. So there's so much good work in here. I can't recommend it enough. Stefan and Tim, congratulations on completing Crickonomics. We will have a link in the show notes to where you can buy it. I assume Amazon's the best bet at this stage based on talking to your publisher. Would that be right?
That sounds fair.
Yeah,
I should say for Aussies, it's only on Australia in August.
Well, but, it might only be around in August, but we'll talk about it.
They can order it now.
Exactly, you can pre-order it. Spot on. Stefan Zeminski, Tim Wigmore, congratulations on the piece of work that is Crickonomics, and looking forward to seeing the response over the next few weeks.
Oh, thanks for having us on, guys.
Cheers, guys. Thanks a lot.
I'm Glenn Maxwell. Make sure you listen to The Final Word with Adam Collins and Jeff Lemon.
Final Word, Adam Collins, Jeff Lemon. Thanks again to Stefan and Tim for coming on and having a chat. As I said off the top, that is the quintessential piece of work from Wiggy. It's like all of his good ideas have been brought into, well, not only the first book, Cricket 2.0, but his this isn't the sequel. It's very different in the way that it comes at these problems, but it's of the same family at the very least, Crickonomics. So I was very happy to receive it in the post and, yes, have them on the show to chat about it.
It was spot on the kind of topic that, like, he would bail you up in a lift and he'd be like, have you ever thought about the fact that there was just talk about players coming from the country in India, but none of them actually come from the country. They're from the country. They come from medium-sized cities. They're small cities, but they're actually quite big cities comparatively. And you'd be like, okay.
Let's do this.
Yeah, sure.
Absolutely.
And then that's a chapter.
Yeah.
Well, look, one of the nice things about doing a podcast is you basically just hang out and have a chat, and often times you get to chat with some interesting people about things they know about. So happy days.
Yes, it is. It's as we said at the top, it's our show, and we'll cry if we want to. That is it for us for another week. If you like what we do, you can support us on Patreon, patreon.com/thefinalword. By going there and submitting a Nerd Pledge, you can be part of the fun we have on the weekend show, which will be coming up on Saturday, episode 91, I think it is, of Nerd Pledge. All of the episodes are at finalwordcricket.com. Thank you to our production team at Bad Producer Production, our editor, Dave Collins, who looks after us so splendidly. And thank you to Tim and Stefan for being guests on the show, woodstockcricket.co.uk, TFW20, if you want to buy yourself a cricket bat. All right, that's it from us. We'll talk to you on the weekend. Bye. I had to go.